You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
So my background, just quickly, I've spent about 10 or 15 years as a community activist or a community organizer. I actually hate the word activist because it divides the world up into activists and those who aren't activists. And we know we've reached a good point when the word activist no longer has any meaning, because ideally we want to be in a culture where everyone is active. I mean, the word activist comes from the word act. I hope everyone is acting to some degree. For us to separate that into a category is a bad start. So I've spent 10 or 15 years as an activist working on issues in Toronto, and I'll spend a few minutes telling some stories about those. But over the last 5 years, I've shifted my focus away from specific political advocacy campaigns and shifted it towards a more broader question, which is, why is it that most people aren't engaged at all? Because while it was very inspiring and nourishing to meet a lot of activists and to meet people who were organizing things in their neighborhood, I couldn't help but realize that out of a city of 3 million people, the activist community was statistically invisible. It was a few hundred people. And I've tried to figure out, what is it that's preventing my mom, my sister, a lot of my old high school friends, people who I know are smart, talented, care about the city, but have never been to City Hall, haven't signed a petition, maybe they vote, maybe not, definitely haven't given a deputation at City Hall about the budget process, etc. And what is it that is holding those people back from becoming leaders and expressing their own views? But let me take a step back first. Quick story about high school, where I got my start in activism in a few ways in high school. And one quick story I like to share. This is my grad photo, 1993. My hair was longer. And you can tell in this photo that I don't look very happy. Can we agree on that? For a few reasons. One is, I'm a teenager. You're not supposed to be happy. But number two, there's a big zit right on my nose there. It's enormous. And it, of course, it grew just on grad photo week. It is symmetrical, and they say symmetry is beauty, or beauty is symmetry, but I don't think that works in this instance. But the other reason I was feeling melancholy in this particular moment is because I was arguing with the photographer. There was a table, kind of like this. I can shine the light anywhere. There was a table like that, and there was a bouquet of flowers on the table. And I said to the photographer, what are the flowers for? And he said, well, the flowers are for women. So all the female grads get to hold the flowers. And I said, cool, can I hold the flowers? And he said, no, of course not. I just told you the flowers are for the women. You're not a woman and you can't hold the flowers. And I kind of wanted to stand my ground. I like flowers. Who likes flowers? See, right? So I'm not crazy. I like flowers. It's my photo. It's not his photo. My mom's paying for it. So technically I'm the customer through one degree of separation. And the customer is always right, I've been told. So I kept kind of pushing this guy. Come on, can I hold the flowers? Can I hold the flowers? And he was getting really annoyed because he has a job to do and his rules were flowers for the girls. And I don't know if it was my pushiness or if I intellectually swayed him or just drove him to the point of frustration. But by the end of the discussion in 1993, I was the only male holding flowers in my yearbook. And the importance of the story is, if you look at my smile, look how much happier I am. It's a complete transformation. And the moral here is that if you stand up for what you believe in, you will be a happier person. And obviously, someone holding flowers or not holding flowers isn't going to change the world. But I do believe in small moments of activism acting as a gateway drug, getting people hooked on the idea that change is possible and that fighting back is worthwhile. So I'm going to tell you a bit about some of the projects I did after high school. I never went to university. I went right into community organizing and activism. I had this real sense of urgency that I won't be content with my life unless somehow I'm contributing towards change. But I had no idea how to do that. They don't teach you that in school, which is a shame. And I'll talk about that in a moment. I moved downtown. I got involved on a bunch of issues. I started a group called the Toronto Public Space Committee. was one issue that I thought wasn't being addressed enough, the idea of what our public spaces are, who owns them, what role they play in society. And a lot of public institutions, when they're under attack, have a natural constituency that rises up to defend them. So if schools are under attack, you'll have parents, teachers, students. If a library is under attack, you've got librarians and library users. But if a park or a sidewalk or an alleyway or public spaces get eroded in certain ways, there isn't a natural union or user group that can rise up. So we started this group, which turned into Spacing Magazine, which is now a nationwide publication about urban issues. And one thing I really like about public space is that it's the great equalizer. So we live in a society with income gaps, of course. And almost everywhere you go, it's very clear who has more money than others. So when I flew to Vancouver a few days ago, there were folks at the front of the plane who get fancier seats, bigger seats, and they get more alcohol. And people with more money go to different restaurants. They buy different cars. They wear different clothes. And the beautiful thing about public space is that no matter how much money you have in your pocket, no one gets to cross the street before you do. No one gets to reserve a park bench or a picnic table. Everyone's equal in public space, and I think it's a sacred space. And one thing I was concerned about was the way we were abusing the visual environment, because an important part of public space is it's also the great equalizer for communication, because most modes of expressing ourselves, and keep in mind, this was before the internet, so it's a little different now. It's very easy now to throw up a website. But at the time, I was really concerned about public space not being used properly, because companies can afford to spend so much money on advertisements and newspapers and magazines, on the radio. We're always being bombarded with ads, buy this, buy that, buy this. And I find those ads to be very demoralizing. They work on the premise that they try and make you feel bad about yourself. And then the second part is they offer you a product to cure whatever is wrong with you. So a lot of ads, before they can sell you the product, have to make you think that you have your teeth aren't white enough. You smell bad. Your clothes, you're wearing the wrong clothes. Your clothes stick to you because of static electricity in a strange and awkward way that makes people look at you like you're you know, weird. But you can fix that with this amazing product. So, you know, do you really want an industry committed to making you feel like crap doing all of your exterior decorating? I don't know. I'd say no. So, but my concern though was about freedom of expression and there not being a price tag on freedom of expression. So, of course, someone like me, or most of you, I'd assume, can't afford a full-page ad in the paper. You can't afford a billboard. But what you can afford is a poster. You can put up posters. You can put up maybe a mural in your neighborhood. And I think that public space should be that space that allows us to actually hear from each other visually. Because, again, in the magazines and the newspapers and the radios, we're getting all these commercial messages. So these billboards were going up like crazy in Toronto. And it was kind of the Wild West. The regulations were being completely ignored, and they were going up right and left all over the place. Meanwhile, they were trying to ban posters. And I don't know if that's the rule here, but that drove me crazy. What an absolute like misuse of public space. So this stuff, again, I find it to be offensive in the content. I also am concerned about the lack of diversity in terms of images. A lot of white faces. Toronto's really proud of our diversity, always ranting and raving. Oh, we're the most diverse city in the world, blah, blah, blah. And then our public square, which should reflect who we are back to us, all the signs are in English. Almost all the models are white. This guy's really white. I don't know what's going on there. And you don't see any kind of marginalized group or demographic beyond this very narrow definition of what beauty is, right? And it's not just white, it's a narrow age demographic, it's a narrow body size, a narrow, in the physical sense, which causes a lot of body issue problems, both for men and for women. You won't see someone with a hearing aid, with a crutch, in a wheelchair. You won't see a same-sex couple holding each other so lovingly as these two are. You won't see someone wearing any clear, identifiable religious garb. So to decorate your public square in a way that doesn't reflect back who you are is kind of a waste of an opportunity, because a public square should be a celebration of who we are. And then again, at the same time, to say, oh, but this is visual clutter. This is visual pollution. We got to get rid of posters. So we launched a campaign to restrict the amount of commercial advertising in public spaces and at the same time fight for the right for people to put up posters. And I found that posters were more likely to represent the diversity of the city, different languages, and things that are actually relevant to people, community meetings, political rallies, local small business, etc. And the funny thing was that I was able to actually organize enough people using creative and fun tactics in a volunteer group with no funding that we were able to actually restrict by billboard expansion and successfully fight against the poster bylaw. And that kind of blew my mind. I had no idea that City Hall was a place that you could navigate. And it took me years to figure out how the place actually works. And when people volunteered, they learned how City Hall works. And it was a really fascinating process. But I also started to feel like people are going to burn out. There's a lot of reading of staff reports and making deputations. And it was very geeky. And I'm pro-geek. I think we have to embrace our inner geek. But I wanted the Public Space Committee to also be fun. And I wanted to create more creative, theatrical, almost abstract, symbolic gestures that raised awareness about these ideas of public space without having to read through staff reports and send a written deputation through the city clerk to a committee. So we did a few fun projects. I'll just share two with you. This is an orphan space. An orphan space is a municipally owned piece of soil that, for whatever reason, has been ignored. So it's between the street and the sidewalk, or between the curb and the sidewalk, or the sidewalk and a building, and it's just, for whatever reason, been abandoned. So we started this fun project called Guerrilla Gardening, where we invited people to vandalize the city with nature, which is technically illegal because you're not supposed to be altering public space, but no one's going to put you in jail, I would hope, for this kind of vandalizing. And we just sent out these invitations. We went out and found these little spaces and invited people to show up, and we said, just bring your spoon. You don't have to be a professional gardener. You don't have to have any experience. You don't need any special equipment. Bring your spoon, and together we will guerrilla garden. And it's kind of like the flowers, in a way, in the grad photo, because obviously these flowers on their own are not going to change the world. In fact, I think most of them died a week later because no one was watering them. But what it does is it rewires something in your mind about who owns public space. And this goes back to the billboards too, because the billboards almost, it's like when dogs pee on something to mark their ownership. It's like the corporations have peed on all of our public space with their billboards. And it gets this, we have this sense that, oh, that can't be our space with all these signs up. And one of the biggest obstacles, I think, preventing people from getting engaged is lacking the sense of collective ownership. Everyone invests a lot of time, energy, pride, and money into things that they know are theirs, that they own. So our homes, our cars, our bicycles, our wardrobe. You've all got nice haircuts. You all probably took a shower sometime in the last day or two or three. I don't know. I won't judge. But when something is ours, we know that if we don't take care of it, no one else will. So I think one thing that could easily help amplify the amount of civic participation is to help build that sense of collective ownership. And fun ways to do that are through symbolic gestures like this, where as soon as that spoon breaks through the soil, that might be the first time in your life that you've actually physically altered something that wasn't legally or monetarily yours, right? And the media really loved this, which is a great thing. The media can be a big part of the problem as well when it comes to political apathy by focusing more on scandals and polarization rather than constructive dialogue. But in this case, the media really loved our work, and even though 30, 40, 50 people would show up to do this, we were able to reach tens of thousands of people through radio, print. If we had just held a press conference about the importance of public space and collective ownership of our commons, blah, 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 like no one would have cared. But by doing it in a creative, theatrical way, we were able to really raise awareness about these issues. And when I did the interviews about them, I explained why we thought this was important from a philosophical point of view. Another fun one was about fences. So a lot of homes have fences in the front yard or the backyard. And when you put a fence in your front yard, you're doing two things. You're putting a fence between you and your neighbor, which is kind of a negative message. It's like, stay away from me, please. Thank you very much. This is the line you shall not cross. But I'm more concerned about the line in front, the fence in front of your house, right? At the edge of your lawn. Because it's kind of giving the finger to the whole city. You know, please, everyone stay away from my house. But more importantly, it's delineating that mark I was saying before about where your ownership ends. So I'm going to take care of my living room, my kitchen, my bedroom, my hallway. I'm going to mow the lawn, plant some flowers. This line demarcates where Gregor Robertson's going to take care of it now. This isn't mine. This belongs to Christy Clark, Gregor, Mr. Harper. It's not my problem. And by taking fences down, you're opening up a neighborhood and taking down that mental barrier of where your responsibility or opportunity, I think, ends and begins. So we launched this fun project called the Downtown Defense Project, where we take down fences. We rid the city of fences. We don't sneak out and take them down at night like the guerrilla gardeners. We would end up in jail if we did that. And my mother would be disappointed. What we do is we put flyers on people's fences. We hang them directly on the fences, saying, we're the Downtown Defense Project. We're opening up neighborhoods. Properties surrounded by chain link tend to look more like jail yards than homes, contributing to feelings of isolation and detachment. An open neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. Don't you think it's time we open up? And we show very clearly how your neighborhood looks now and how it could look. And then we invited people to contact us to, number one, volunteer to take down fences, and number two, call us to request a free fence removal. And it was a bit of an experiment, which all my work has been very kind of entrepreneurial in the sense that I had no idea if it would work or not. And of course, I'm just sharing the ones that did. It's a much better story that way. So I didn't know if anyone would phone to take fences down. I didn't know if I'd have any volunteers, but sure enough, the phone started ringing, and I got calls from people saying, yeah, take down my fence. I've never thought about it before. I'm always busy with my kids or my work, and I bought the house, and there was a fence, and I've never thought about it. It was never a priority, at which point I was kind of like, well, shit, I don't know how to take down a fence. Look at these are like metal poles going into concrete. I have no idea what to do. So I started researching it and learned about power tools and sawzalls and grinders. And then I sent out an email to this growing list of volunteers who we had met through the postering campaign, the billboard campaign, other public space issues we were fighting against, closed circuit television cameras all across the downtown, and the guerrilla gardeners. And I said, okay, show up. Who wants to help me to take down a fence? Don't bring a spoon this time. Just bring a pair of pliers. That's all you have to do. And sure enough, these weird people showed up. And Jonathan Goldsby, he got involved with the Public Space Committee. He had never been to City Hall before. And now he's the chief urban affairs writer for our weekly downtown magazine. And it was the Public Space Committee using this magical recipe of the theatrical combined with the policy-based advocacy that brought in people beyond the usual suspects. And we took down the fences. We've taken a whole bunch down. Here's a before picture and an after picture. Same property, an hour later. And again, just like the grad photo, they're obviously not happy here. They're invisible. And they're eating. They're probably smiling here because I gave them all free ice cream. There's Goldsby again. So that was a really fun project, and that did two things. It again, you know, cemented that idea of collective ownership, although in this case it's not a public space, but it's taking down the delineation between the private and the public. But the other thing this does is, in both of these cases, the gardening and the fences, is that it presents a manifestation of the malleability of the universe. So I talked before about how one of the things holding people back is lacking the sense of collective ownership. The second thing would be lacking a sense of malleability. So this podium is very solid. You can't change its shape without, I guess, grinding it down. And if one of you got in your head the idea that this podium would be better if it was a different shape, you wouldn't be motivated to come down and try and manipulate it because you know it doesn't move. And I think that's how most people see the world. I think that's how they see a missing bike lane or a missing library or a missing pool or whatever it is policy-wise they think should change. What's holding them back is a sense that nothing changes. So why would you invest your time into something that is futile? And the truth is anything can change. And massive social change has happened through history because for whatever reason, people said, okay, that's it. This is going to change. now. And of course, it takes another 100 years for it to change. But the starting point is that acceptance of malleability. And the defense project and the guerrilla gardening, I think, rewire people's minds, especially those who participate in it directly, because once you've put that spoon again through the ground or taken down the fence, you're exercising your right to manipulate things that are malleable, which is something we don't usually do beyond our own homes. This is our website, and I've got this slide just to show the combination of the gardening and the defencing side by side with the policy-based stuff. And I think it was something very magical, and I think groups tend to think we can either be theatrical or we can be policy-based. And if we're policy-based, we can't be too silly. And if we're a theatrical group, we shouldn't be too political. And I think mixing it together is actually really effective. And we never had funding, never had an office, never had staff, but in a city of almost 3 million people, we were voted as the best activist group by both of our weekly magazines. And again, I think part of that was taking that unique approach. We even ended up on the front cover of our weekly paper. And I think if we had just been an advocacy group, I don't think we would have been on there. And if we had just been some kind of, we take fences down just for fun, I don't think that would have done it either. People were really attracted to the fact that we were breaking down those narrow rules of how a nonprofit can look. And a lot of these people went on to take leadership roles in other groups, including the executive director of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, Josh Patterson, right there, 2005. The project I did most recently is called The Fourth Wall. And it was a project that explored what is preventing people from engaging municipally. And it's a theater term that I stole and co-opted. Who's heard of The Fourth Wall as a theater term? Great. Amazing. Okay, so for those who don't know, if I'm on a stage, and I suppose I am, there'd be a wall behind me, a wall on my right, a wall on my left, and this is the fourth wall. It's a virtual wall that isn't actually there, unless you go see Pink Floyd, the wall. They build it, but then they take it down. And the fourth wall is a theater term to represent the defense between the audience and the stage. And it works in different ways for the audience and then for the actors. For the actors, it's an opaque wall that you never look through. If I'm a really good actor, you will cease to exist in my world, and I'll fall into this reality that is separate from yours, and I'll never look at you or acknowledge your existence. And again, if I'm really in character, you'll literally disappear. You, on the other hand, as the audience, if this was some kind of Shakespearean theater, are constantly looking through the fourth wall, the exact opposite of me, but completely passively, not talking to each other, not talking to me. And I use it as an analogy because I think politically a lot of people interact with decision-making in the same way. So politics is something that happens over there. It's not something where I'm supposed to be on the stage or speaking to. It's something you watch once every 4 years, like in place of vote. But other than that, they take care of it. It's that fence. It's the distance, the separation. And I think what we want to create is a culture where the fourth wall is broken. And the theater term is actually used in the context of breaking the fourth wall. So when an actor actually looks at the audience, even just for a moment, even for a wink, it's called breaking the fourth wall. And what they're doing for that moment is acknowledging that we're all in the same room. That I know you're here, you know I'm here, and I know that you know that I know that you're here. And on and on and on. And it's a great dynamic for theater. You want to have that separation. And I think politically, you definitely don't want to have that separation. We want to create a culture where people know that they belong on the stage, that heckling is almost an obligation, and that you can run for office too. And actually, people need to know where the stairs are to get on the stage, and that it's not a spectator sport. It's not something you watch passively. There's actually a great image in the new mayor. Who here was involved with the mayor's task force? Hands up, anyone? It's amazing. Stand up for a second. Round of applause. Stand up, stand up. If you haven't downloaded the document, it's downloadable, I assume, and there's going to be a kiosk here, too, for feedback. It's amazing. It's brilliant, really small, tangible, concrete steps Vancouver can do. Anyways, there's a cute picture in there that also kind of illustrates the same idea of these two groups. There's the audience, there's the stage, and how do we create a kind of back-and-forth dialogue between the two? So the exhibit goes through all these different recommendations, 36 recommendations of how to make local municipal politics more accessible and participatory. And some of them came out of a TED Talk I did a few years ago. I'll start with this one quickly. And I've got some copies that I brought with me. If anyone's really interested, I've got copies available. It's also all online, thefourthwall.ca. You can download the PDF. It's all there. And most of it, I think, can be transplanted to Vancouver. So this one is about public notices. And some of you may have seen notices like this. Vancouver's are similar. And I mentioned this in my TED Talk. This is allegedly designed to inform the public that something important is happening in their neighborhood that they should know about and that maybe they could interact with the process and submit feedback. But it's not designed very well. I would even say that using the word design at all is generous. Very generous. This is designed in Microsoft Word, which is not a design program. And it's probably designed by a lawyer. And lawyers shouldn't design things. You need to get halfway down in tiny, tiny font to even see which address it's about. Why would anyone actually even care about the ad if they don't know if it's about their neighborhood? And you don't have that at the top. It's halfway down. So right off the bat, no one's ever going to read this ad, ever. And then you have to get all the way to the bottom. Again, tiny font. They're not even using very affordable modern technology such as bold, underline. These are very effective tools. So in my TED Talk, I asked the audience a hypothetical question. Imagine how foolish it would look if the private sector used the same design techniques on their billboards and ads in magazines. If Nike wanted to sell a pair of shoes and they hired the same lawyer to make their ad, it would look something like this. All the information's there, right? It's a very informative ad. And you're laughing at it because it looks like a really crappy ad, right? Like you probably wouldn't buy those shoes. You wouldn't even notice that ad. And it is funny, but it's also terribly depressing. Because the reason you'll never see an ad like that is because Nike actually wants you to buy their shoes. And the message we get from the city when they have this is that, well, I guess they don't actually want us to submit our input because they're not even trying at all to catch our attention and give us the information we need. So I took it a step further. So those are the print ads. We also have signs. You have these in Vancouver too. Signs that go outside to show that there's a development. Again, totally crappy design. No color. What is that? Like, really? How is it that every single automobile in Ontario can be uniquely identified with a 7-digit license plate and they need 13 digits to identify a few hundred planning submissions? There's also a lot of kind of exclusionary language, statutory public meeting. First rule, if you want to get more people to a statutory public meeting, don't call it a statutory public meeting, right? Sounds like you don't even want to have it. And don't use alienating insider academic jargon like all of these things. And of course, if you're going to have signs that say statutory public meeting, information will be posted. They never post it. I don't know if you do that in Vancouver. There's never actually any information about when the meeting is. Then you got stuff like this, including this building is going to include a 4-story podium, right? Now, a podium, if you're an urban planner, you might know that a podium means the base of a building underneath a tower. Most people don't know that. When they think of a podium, they think of something like this. And they're going to be thinking, well, why the hell would I want a 4-story podium in my neighborhood? Think of the noise pollution, right? The energy consumption to fuel this, and the architecture is completely inappropriate, and it's blocking the sidewalk. Then you got things like, includes 4 levels of below-grade parking, which means underground, but it sounds like it's just crappy parking, right? I want high-grade parking, right? When I think of below grade, I think of high school. This is my report card from 91. That's below grade, right? Imagine if people actually talk that way. Like, no one says below grade, but what do they say? They say underground, right? That would be a really weird name for a transit system, right? Or imagine a band called the Velvet Below Grade. It just doesn't sound good. So the question is, why are you laughing now at this, but not laughing when you see that same language on municipal signs? We've almost become like accepting of the fact that these signs are so lousy and terrible and don't actually speak to us. So what I did is I didn't want to just complain. Well, in the TED Talk, I complained. Their TED Talks are short, so you can't do a lot. But I wanted to take a step forward after that. So what I did is I did a call for submissions, and I asked designers, how would you design a public notice if you wanted to actually achieve four things? Number one, catch people's attention with basic design principles, color, images, fonts, etc. Number two, give people the basic information they need to know what's happening in their neighborhood. What's the point of this ad? Say it clearly. Number three, clearly indicate what the points of opportunity are for submitting your feedback back into the decision-making process. And number four, most importantly, proactively encouraging that participation. Not just saying you're allowed to submit your input, but we really want it, right? That's what Nike does. They don't just say, oh, we have some shoes. They're like, this shoes will change your life, right? We need to like cut through all that corporate messaging with our own messaging that is as exciting and creative and vibrant. So we got the most amazing things sent in. We're listening Toronto. This has color. I'm just going to back up a bit. Good use of fonts, images, clear icons of how you can submit your input. We're all ears. We're listening to you. Speak up Toronto. Again, color, clear icons. What do you think? Let us know. Exclamation mark. Those are very handy. Another exclamation mark. Exclamation marks are free to use, and they get people really excited. Before and after picture is good. I've got a slide coming up from the mayor's panel, from the task force. One of the things that really jumped out in the entire report was this line. Is this the final report? No! Exclamation mark. And it's like really big right across the whole page. And they could have just said, this is not the final step. This is the first step. But they asked us a question in huge bold with a big capital, capital N and exclamation mark. And it's one of the only things that really stood out for me after the report. I was like, okay, I know this is not the final report. Exclamation marks are very amazing. We should use them more. Great, big image, icons. Please let us know what you think. This one then came in, and this was the most exciting one, because this wasn't from a designer who had seen my blog. This was from the communications department in Pemberton, British Columbia. And they had seen my TED Talk, seen my blog, seen the fourth wall, and completely redesigned their actual public notice template based on the recommendations of the notices you just saw. So taking a whole bunch of Have Your Say, We're Listening, the icons, they got all those from those designers who had sent those things to me through my blog. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. I didn't actually think, even I didn't think there was malleability there, right? And there was, of course. Any city can change their public notice. So this got some national coverage because I started blogging about it. And then I thought, these guys deserve an award, right? They should get an award for this. And I learned that if you make an award and frame it and give it to people, they get really excited. Even if you just printed it in your home, like in your office, you got to try this. Give awards to people. Like they put it up on their wall. So this is the award. It's the Dazzling Notice Award. It doesn't say from Dave Meslin, because that would, you know, show how useless it is. Don't put that part on. Take that part off. It's not from anyone. Look, it doesn't say who it's from. And here they are. It's the mayor of Pemberton, Jordan Sturdy, Jill Brooksbank, and the CAO. I flew out there. We did a presentation. I gave them an award. It was great. And now we've turned it into a national program. The DNA Awards have just launched for 2013. It's dazzleawards.ca. We've put together an amazing juried panel that includes some of your staff here from your civic engagement department, includes the chief planner of Toronto, Jen Keysmat, Naheed Nenshi's chief of staff. So across the country, they're going to be judging who's going to win. So now I'm using guilt and shame and embarrassment to get cities fighting with each other to win this award that I just made up. It's amazing. So it shows how much you can do with like no resources and a printer. Thanks. Another section in the Fourth Wall exhibit looks at the civics programs we have or don't have. So obviously if we want adults to be engaged when they're, you know, grown up, they need to be given the tools when they're younger of how government works. It's impossible to engage with something if you haven't been given the roadmap of how the process works. So in Ontario, we do a half credit. That's it, just a half credit of civics in grade 10, which is not even close to being enough. There should be a full credit every year. There's so much to learn about government and the nonprofit sector. And they do it. American history gets a full credit. That's a different country. Full credit. Canadian civics, half credit. And they put it in the history department, which is really weird because civics is like all about learning about the present to change the future. It has nothing to do with the past. And it's the malleability. The one thing you can't change is the past. And then they put civics under history. Wow. Anyways. So, but great best practices here. Calgary, forever in Calgary, or Edmonton. I haven't been to the one in Edmonton. I've been to the one in Calgary. They have a City Hall school. It's a classroom in City Hall. On the main floor, you walk into City Hall in Calgary, classroom like the size of this whole space here, huge glass wall where the students and the people outside can see each other. And they spend 5 days there, classes with their teacher, interacting with city staff, interacting with counselors, and doing hands-on education about municipal governance. Amazing. Toronto, we don't have anything like that at all. What's this? That's right. It's the manual that comes with IKEA furniture. And now you're all thinking about monkeys. That's okay. Get the monkey out of your head. Okay, great. So imagine getting a piece of IKEA furniture and not getting this with it, right? It's hard enough to put it together with this, right? Because you get all these different, you'll get like, look, that one's smaller than that one. They always do that. There'll be like 10 different size. Why can't they have all the same size bolts and screws? There'll be like 10 different ones. And then even with the instructions, I find that it can take a long time. Imagine trying to figure out all from scratch of how to put it together. I think that's what most people's relationship is with democracy and with government. And if you don't have that roadmap, and you're not taught the difference between municipal jurisdiction, provincial and federal, and how the budget process works, the difference between operating budget and capital budget, and how to make a deputation and the committee structure. I mean, how could you possibly engage? How could you possibly find how your voice fits into that model? Okay, so this is a fun one. How many minutes do I have left? I brought a timer. I'm very responsible. I brought a timer up on stage, and I didn't press go. So it's at zero, which is not accurate. Where are we at, roughly? Five? Okay, great. We're going to do a quick interactive thing. I need two volunteers on stage. This is about voting reform. Any two. Self-select. Amazing. Wow, we have one eager person. You coming down? Okay. So one thing that I think really holds people back from engaging and really perpetuates apathy and negative feelings towards democracy is our really crappy voting system. It's called First Past the Post, and it's garbage. It's absolute garbage. And I just want to talk quickly about a simple voting reform that could be implemented anywhere. And I'm running a campaign called Rabbit, Ranked Ballot Initiative of Toronto, and the website is rabbit.ca. And I want to show quickly how it works. So you two are running for mayor, okay? And the issue of the day is shoes versus boots. It's a very divisive issue, right? Do you want a mayor with shoes or do you want a mayor with boots? And it's not something that you take lightly. You have to give it a lot of thought. Why should the city have a mayor with shoes?
They're easier to remove at the end of the day.
Which gives you more time to do your work, rather than like wasting all your time getting boots off.
And you just don't have to be wearing shoes as long or boots as long in the day, which I think is better for your feet.
All right. Shoes for mayor. But well, hold on a second. What about boots? Boots, mayor?
Well, boots like this get lots of attention, so people often comment on them, and it gives me confidence. And when you have confidence, then you, even if you don't know what you're talking about, you learn what you should talk about and figure it out. And so fancy boots help that.
So true. 80% of leadership is faking confidence. So we have the election, they have their platforms, they have debates, they have ads in the paper, and 60% of the population went with your argument. 60% want a mayor with shoes. 40% want a mayor with boots. So if there were to be an election today, everyone's going to vote. Who's going to win? Right, what was your name?
Julia.
Julia's the mayor. Round of applause. Do you want to come up here for a second? They're beautiful. So city's getting more engaged. People are really getting into politics now. It's before election day. We have another candidate with shoes. Why shoes?
Shoes express the inner nerd of me.
And that's good for the city because?
All cities should be run by nerds.
Oh, okay. All cities should be run by nerds. I agree. So, Julia, you don't get all those votes anymore. So now of the 60% who want shoes, they have two options, and they're going to split that vote. Okay, so same numbers, 60% want shoes, 40% want boots. Who wins now? Okay, that's kind of weird, right? Right? That's called first past the post, which is funny because there's actually no post to pass in first past the post, which we'll talk about in a second. So the real problem here, and this is what I want to stress, isn't that the numbers are unfair, and the numbers are unfair. The real problem is that what happens under these systems, and we've seen this recently with the Green Party in British Columbia being accused of splitting the left, and we used to have the Reform splitting the right, and this and that. People are criticized for running. What will actually happen in this race for mayor is that a week or two or a month or three or four before the election, one of you two are going to be told not to run. You're messing it up. You're helping her win. You were here first. Although statistically, the people who are more likely to be pushed out are actually women, youth, and candidates of color. And the people more likely to be the front runner, especially mayoralty races across Canada, tend to be white men. And it's staggering how many men are mayors of cities across Canada right now. And the other way to do an election, though, is called a runoff. That's how we choose our leaders, which have a much higher percentage of women, I would point out, in this province and Alberta and Ontario and Quebec. So how does a runoff work? None of you got a majority. This should be called first past the post. The post is 50%. You have to pass the post. Under first past the post, there is no post to pass. Is it confusing? I know. It sounds stupid. That's because it is. Under first past the post, you don't have to pass anything. It should actually be called closest to the post. The post being 100%. And you win. You're 40. What did you pass? You passed nothing. Right? Anyway, so the system I'm proposing is called instant runoff voting, but it should actually be called first past the post being 50. Do you get that? Okay, so you're out. You got the least votes. And they have a second round where your votes get transferred back to you, and those who wanted shoes are able to win. It does a few things. If you have runoffs, everyone is welcome to run. No one's accused of being the Ralph Nader or the Greens. Everyone can vote with their heart. No one has to vote strategically, and the voters actually get what they want. Now, round of applause for our volunteers. And I should point out that in Vancouver, you could do something even better. Because in a single-member district like we have in Toronto, we just have one member for each ward, you won't get proportional results out of that. So the shoes won in the end, which is great because most people want to shoes. But the best system is proportional representation, where in the end, the council would actually reflect 60% wanting shoes and the 40% who want boots. Now, you guys had a referendum here in 05. And a referendum in 09 for a system called the single transferable vote. 58% voted yes in 05, and it was significantly lower in 09. But Vancouver voted yes, I believe, both times. Yeah? And what I want to propose to you is that voting reform could start municipally instead of provincially. And Vancouver right now is in an amazing position to be the first jurisdiction anywhere in Canada to implement proportional representation. You have the support of your mayor. And you might not know this, but in 2009, one of the biggest celebrities to endorse the Yes campaign for STV was a woman broadcaster named Christy Clark. And she went on the radio, and this is on YouTube, you can find it, did a 5-minute monologue about how great STV would be for BC politics. So I encourage you to get involved with a group called Fair Vote Canada and Fair Voting BC and try and get STV implemented for Vancouver City Council. Because the most toxic thing we could ever have in politics is someone running for office as a Green or as an NDP or whatever, and then being told that, and this happens municipally too and all across Toronto, that you've ruined it. That you've made this worse, and that if you hadn't run, politics would be better. And people also are really turned off by having to vote strategically. And people are really turned off by getting fake majority governments, which we have in this province and we have in Canada. And it's a huge problem. And you can change it here. So I really want to encourage you to do that. Well, I won't do this one with the volunteers, but I'll just show you quickly that in Toronto, and this could happen anywhere for mayor too, if you had a situation with an 80% and a 20% split where an incumbent city councillor or mayor only had 20% support, 80% didn't want them back, in a normal one-on-one race, they would lose really bad. And the irony of first past the post is that the more candidates that run, the less likely you'll have change. So if five people run against, you probably can't see that, that 80% breaks up into all these numbers and you could actually win an election with 20%. Our current system punishes more engaged populations by splitting the vote for change. I'm going to close up by summarizing what the four things are that I think we need to deliver to people to give them a sense of empowerment so they can become engaged citizens. Number one is a sense of confidence that their opinion matters. And I talked about the fourth wall, the sense of knowing that you belong on the stage rather than sitting passively in the audience. And a great analogy here is the relationship we have to the principal's office in school. Right? So what does it mean if you've been to the principal's office? If you go home and your parents find out that you were in the principal's office, you're in trouble. You did something wrong. That's how we teach people what authority means from a young age. Shouldn't the principal's office be the place you're invited to when you have a good idea about how to make the school better and you need to explain your idea to the principal because he or she wants to hear it and wants to talk to you about how maybe we could implement that idea to improve your classroom, right? But we teach kids from a young age that authority is something to be avoided, and it's a bad thing when you interact with authority. So that's one of the biggest things we're missing, the idea that leadership and authority is something that we should be interacting with and that, again, we belong on that stage. Number two, giving people that map, the IKEA map, the civics classes. Without the tools to navigate the decision-making process, there's no way people can be involved. Number three, that sense of malleability. People think that the world is static around them, that things can change. There's no motivation to get involved and try and figure out how to invest energy towards that change. And number four is that sense of collective ownership. If you don't feel that it's yours and it belongs to Gregor and Stephen and Christy, why would you get involved again? And any one of these four missing negates the other three, right? If you have the confidence and the tools and the malleability but not that sense of ownership, you're not going to try and make a difference. If you have the confidence, tools, and ownership, but not the sense of malleability, you're not going to make the difference. These four things combined, I think, is what gives people the sense of opportunity, that change is possible, and that my actions can contribute towards that change. And I think leadership isn't about figuring out what you can do as a leader to make the world better. Leadership is about trying to figure out how to instill these four things in all the people around you, so you could help them develop their leadership skills. And I think if we can do that, we can help create the communities we all want to live in. Thank you very much.